Nice to talk to you, Arjun.
Nice to talk to you.
So I have visited your website, of course, and you are holding one of the most elaborate-looking, fancy-looking instruments you could lay eyes on. And I just pictured you as a toddler seeing that in your parents' home and thinking, yeah, I want to play that.
Yeah, sitars are built even today in the modern era of efficiency and sort of functionality. They're still built by hand, and the craftsmen really take a lot of pride to make them into works of art and not just beautiful instruments as well. But of course, when I started, I didn't have the gem of an instrument, vintage instrument that I play now. I actually had a three-quarter size child sitar. And I started when I was 5, and I was actually not even able to hold the instrument. So my father, who was my first teacher and also a very ingenious person, had the idea to actually use a dining room chair and prop up the sitar sort of at an angle and tie it to that chair so that I could actually play it, because I couldn't even hold it up myself.
Is there children's repertoire that goes along with learning the sitar as a beginner?
I wouldn't say there's particularly children's repertoire, but there is sort of traditional beginner's repertoire and a vast variety of difficulty. And one thing you have to understand with the repertoire for Indian classicals, so it's not quite as fixed as when we talk about repertoire for, say, you know, a piece of Western classical music. So the way North Indian classical music has evolved is that while there are pieces that have been handed down for centuries, the main thing that's been handed down melodically is this concept of a raga. And the raga is sort of a somewhat general and somewhat specific melodic concept that allows you to have sort of almost like a pre-built song designed for you within the raga, but have enough freedom that you can actually improvise yourself. But of course, improvisation is a more complex, higher level skill, so we don't usually start, especially children, doing that right off the bat. But we focus on, as you would expect, simpler melodies. And in melodic forms that are, say, more major scale and less sort of difficult to play.
Are you looking at sheet music, or at this point are you already committing tunes to ear one by one?
Very good question. So the kind of function of sheet music is also very difficult, different, in our music. Our music basically evolved as a solo or duet or maybe trio art form. And with the large importance of improvisation and the cultural importance in India of memorizing, not only in music, but in many other fields, memorizing the knowledge that's handed down, it's really never gotten to the point of development in terms of writing things down that we've done in the West. And it makes perfect sense. You know, when you have an orchestra of, you know, even 20, 30, much less, you know, 80 musicians on stage, you have to have things written down. You can't really expect every musician to have, you know, 50 pages of music memorized or that sort of thing. And it's also so crucial in group musical forms to have everybody do their job at the perfect time and the perfect rhythm, the perfect melody, right? In our music, because the lead performer is basically weaving a melody on the spot, they're weaving music on the spot, the importance of sheet music is much less. So we do have a modern form of sheet music for North Indian classical, but it's actually derived from European classical notation, because of course, India being a former British colony had, you know, a lot of exposure to those sort of methods for communicating music.
Where did you grow up, Arjun?
So I grew up in upstate New York in a tiny little town that most people wouldn't know of, but it was called Oneonta. And the reason my family settled there was kind of a in-between point for some of the various work my father was doing as a touring musician and teacher. And So, we were certainly the only ones in the town who were doing my style of music. And so in that way, it was very insular. But from the very beginning, my father had exposed our family to all kinds of great music, including the maestros of Indian classical music, but also a lot of European classical. And he made a lot of his career through touring, especially in Europe. And he had many, many musician friends of all different styles of music. So he would bring back a lot of music and really kept us exposed to great music. And one of the musicians whom I most connected with listening to his albums as a kid was Maestro Ali Akbar Khan. And he was actually my father's, one of his main teachers, and he had learned with him in India primarily. And Ali Akbar Khan was basically, he was like a Beethoven sort of figure in our music, or in the modern day, you might say like a Yo-Yo Ma of his instrument, which was the sarod. And the sarod is a little less well-known than the sitar, but it's a 25-stringed lute-like instrument. And it has a goatskin head on the right side, and the left side, the melody side, is actually a steel plate, so it's fretless, just like a cello or violin. And so he was basically the world's most famous, most and most unique, really, sarod player, and one of the most knowledgeable musicians of the 20th century, who was really passing down the lineage that he had learned from his father, which dated back centuries of this music. So amazing turn in my life that I actually got to meet him as a kid. My father's connection, of course, helped make that happen. And then when I was a young teenager, my father brought me out here to San Francisco Bay, where Ali Akbar Khan founded the Ali Akbar College of Music in 1967 and actually did most of his teaching and lived here in the West, in America. And so I met him, re-met him as a young teenager and started learning with him. And it kind of, the rest is history, as they say.
So California, the San Francisco area offered masters to learn from. Did it also offer a knowledgeable listening audience that could appreciate the kind of music that you play and maybe even follow your development as a player?
Yeah, that's a great question. It absolutely does. Because the Ali Akbar College has been here and continues to be here, and has taught so many students and has hosted so many concerts, it's definitely built a community in the Bay of people who have, some of them, a deep knowledge of Indian classical, and a lot of them at least a basic knowledge of it. And it helps their appreciation in a way they can experience some of and understand some of the more subtle sort of things that are going on during a performance and enjoy that as well. And the other thing that happened as a result of Ali Akbar Khan settling here in San Francisco was that a lot of the other greatest maestros of their respective instruments of North Indian classical were attracted here by his presence, including the tabla maestros, world-famous Zakir Hussain and Swapan Chaudhary, the latter of whom is still teaching art at the Ali Akbar College and is touring around the world. And the Bansuri master, G.S. Sachdev, the dance master, Pandit Chitrash Das, and many others. So it really created snowballed into a wonderful area for Indian classical appreciation and teaching. Other schools popped up, and of course, just with the demographic of Silicon Valley having a lot of engineers from India and this sort of thing, people who had some cultural background and interest in Indian classical have augmented the scene here.
So you can feel the audience following the raga, following your variations of it, and that must be really satisfying. You may not, if I'm in the audience for the concert, I will be appreciating many of the things I know how to appreciate about live performance, but following a raga is not necessarily one of those things.
Right. Right. And one of the great things about this music is that it has something to offer at really every level that you experience it at. So that's a great point. You know, so many people have not even heard about this genre of music around the world. And as much as, you know, I wish that it were a worldwide phenomenon in a bigger way than it already is and more people knew about it, it's also an opportunity in that people get to experience it fresh, and to them it's something very novel and different. And our music has something to offer, you know, if you've never heard it before or if you've been listening to it for 50 years, there's something to find in it that's enjoyable. And it's also my playing instrumental music. It's not lyrical, so it's not like you have the barrier, language barrier of listening to, say, songs in Hindi or something like that. So in my particular case, in a way, even easier to connect, because I firmly believe music is music, and it's an amazing part of the human experience. And the lines we draw between genres and between approaches to music are really not as hard as we might think once we get to know those genres.
Do most of the people you meet who play Indian classical music come from families who have family members that also played Indian classical music? Is this something that is mostly inherited from parent to child?
Mm-hmm. Very good question. Traditionally, if we look back, say, more than 150 years, the music was sort of passed down along hereditary line. In fact, some of the lineages, well, most of them, they basically, they guarded their art because that was kind of their proprietary, you know, secret, if you will, in that day and age. So their techniques and their repertoire were really closely guarded against sort of rival musicians learning it. And there was also an extreme sort of reverence for the tradition itself and a desire to not want to pass it on to someone who wasn't going to be seriously dedicated to it. So the way it worked out is that typically the musicians were teaching only their blood relatives. Now that changed with some musicians, including Alauddin Khan, who's the father of Ali Akbar Khan, and incidentally also the teacher of the famous sitar maestro, Ravi Shankar, who became known in the West in the 60s. With his work with the Beatles. So Alauddin Khan was actually the first in our lineage who was not a blood relative of his master, his teacher. And he had to basically come up with ways of even meeting that master and arranging his tutelage with him by convincing the sort of provincial king of the time who employed this master. So he really had to struggle a lot even to be able to learn the music. But once he got that connection, the master saw that he was just a prodigy and a genius, basically, and just gave him everything he knew. So now, since his time in our lineage, that sort of culture has really changed, and his philosophy was really to teach anyone who was deserving, not to just, you know, kind of squander the music on anyone, but if someone showed real dedication, doesn't matter what you look like, what you came from, and where you came from, or your relationship to the teacher, you deserve to learn it, you know. So in terms of our student body now, say at the Ali Akbar College where I teach, and even at other schools around the world, you see a mix of both. Certainly families who have some Indian classical in their background. And I would say you see this for other forms of music too. You know, if you have a parent who plays guitar or plays violin or something or played piano, even as a kid, they're often more inclined to have their kids start lessons when they're young. So that's certainly the case with some of our students. But there's many, many people who were just exposed to it either as adults or kids, and they're starting off fresh. They're the first in their families. And in some ways, there are advantages to that, even because they have kind of a fresh slate. They don't have any preconceived notions. And say, if I'm working with a student like that, I really get the chance to build up their appreciation and their understanding of the music step by step.
You mentioned Ravi Shankar, who helped popularize the sound and create some awareness and understanding in the world mm-hmm. in his day. And you too have participated in some interesting projects, right? Where mm-hmm. you've taken your instrument and turned it into part of a crossover or... I'm thinking of a Venn diagram where there's Western classical and Indian classical, and then you meet in the middle somewhere.
Absolutely.
If you have a particular example of how you've done that, I'd like to hear about it.
Yeah, well, like I said, I mean, I really believe that music is something that belongs to humanity at large, and our various genres are not really as separate as we think. And this point has really been proven to me in working with other musicians and learning myself about other forms of music. Of course, growing up here in America, I played band instruments as a kid. I used to play in wind ensembles and that sort of thing. And so much of what I had learned in Indian classical, I thought, these are the same concepts that I'm seeing when I'm playing band repertoire. There's so much shared territory. Of course, there are unique aspects to each music that really help them stand out. So from there, I've always had that kind of openness to let's see what happens if we try this music or even just my instrument out of its usual context. So one of the more successful projects I did was working with opera company and St. Louis Symphony, so Opera Theater of St. Louis, who had commissioned a new work based on a Salman Rushdie novel, Shalimar the Clown. And it was a project was led by composer Jack Perla and libretto by Rajiv Joseph. So it was a fresh piece that they were commissioning, and I had done some work with Jack previously, who's a fantastic composer and jazz pianist, and also deeply trained in the Western classical tradition. So because the plot of the story actually took place across India and Europe and the United States, he wanted to have a real sort of authentic Indian classical presence and a score among some of the other genres he wove into his creation. So I was able to work with him over about a year and a half, kind of advising him, giving him some ideas, and composing some of the themes that he ultimately wove into the piece, and we premiered it in 2016, and the album came out last year. And it was a lot of fun to be able to work with certainly musicians, the fantastic musicians of Opera Theater, as well as St. Louis Symphony. And we learned a lot from doing it, and it's really informed the projects that I've done since then and have doing now.
How many performances did it run?
So I did a short run of six performances in the festival season there, almost all sold out.
You were on stage or in the pit?
I was in the pit. Much as I love to be on stage, we had to, let the singers and actors have their live light.
Still, they couldn't have done it without you. That's wonderful.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Okay, well, you have a friend coming to join you in this concert for the Bullock Performance Institute series, and he'll be playing tabla, which is a percussion instrument.
That's right.
Do you play in unison, or do you play sort of back and forth call response? How does that work?
Yeah, very good question. Nitin Mitta will be coming from the East Coast, a fantastic tabla player, plays with a lot of the top maestros who tour through the U.S., so he'll be playing with tabla drums. It's a two-piece drum, basically two small hand drums which sit on the floor, one of which is a treble drum, one of which is a bass drum. If you've never heard them, I strongly encourage you Google it, look it up. They're amazingly expressive instruments with so many kinds of tones that come out of them. And at such speed, it's really incredible. And they're really the perfect complement to performing on sitar. They have the finesse and the delicacy to complement an instrument which is quite quiet and subtle, the sitar. But they also have the dynamism and the power to match its brightness and its boldness. And the way we play together, the format has some similarities, you might say, to a typical format in a jazz piece, in that when we start playing together, I'll play the theme, what we call the usually a gut, or, you know, say if it were a singer, singing would be the song. And we sort of quote the top of the theme, play through a number of fixed lines, and then we open it up for solos. And in a two-performer performance like this, we'll often take turns, or I may do a series of smaller solos and then give it in a turn to answer on the tabla. So that's the basic way we interact. And then there are other ways in which we can subtly throw in variations while the other person is improvising, to kind of interact with them simultaneously.
You know, I think we have to leave it there for now. I think a lot of listeners will have their ears perked up for something a little off the beaten path, although there is a significant community of Indian classical music lovers here. I have actually been at concerts where I was just, my eyes were closed. This is really beautiful. And suddenly the whole crowd starts laughing. And I was, and I don't understand.
Yeah. So that, you know, those are the kind of things when, as you get to know the music more, there are sort of little games we play, so to speak, on stage. One of which that comes to mind that sometimes rouses laughter in the audience is the melodic player sort of starting on a simple enough pattern that the drummer can play simultaneously that pattern while they're keeping track of time mentally. And they're aiming for a particular, to finish the line on a particular beat, the big downbeat, right? And the tabla player's job is actually to guess what the lead instrumentalist is going to play, who's not playing something fixed. They're improvising it. So sometimes we kind of tease each other and sort of fake out that we're going to go for a certain sort of pattern, and then we don't, or leave a silence there. And it can be quite, you know, humorous as we kind of challenge each other to read each other's minds. So there's all kinds of fun sort of games like that. And the audience really, you know, as you mentioned, they really get into it. You know, people even yell out, you know, traditionally in Hindi, things like kya baat or other expressions, which basically mean, you know, wow, and that was great, you know. And there's, so there's really that sort of passion that traditionally the audiences share because it is improvised, and the performers, you know, feel what the audience likes, what they enjoy, and even just their general mood. That all is sort of part of the soup out of which the improvisations get created.
It was really nice talking to you, Arjun, and we'll see you.
It's been a pleasure.
Wednesday night. Bye-bye.
Sounds good. Hope to see you all there. Bye.